Christ examines his churches. In Revelation chapter 1 verses 9 through 20, and I didn't get that on the screen, but I should have. Revelation chapter 1 verses 9 through 20, we have a vision, the first of, seemingly the first of John's visions that he was given, that he put down in the book of Revelation. First John, or Revelation 1, the beginning in verse 9, I, John, both your brother and companion in the tribulation and kingdom and patience of Jesus Christ, was on the island that is called Patmos for the word of God and for the testimony of Jesus Christ. I was in the spirit of the Lord today, and I heard behind me a loud voice as of a trumpet, saying, I am the Alpha and the Omega, the first and the last. And what you see, write in a book and send it to the seven churches which are in Asia, to Ephesus, to Smyrna, to Pergamos, to Thyatira, to Sardis, to Philadelphia, and to Laodicea. Then I turned to see the voice that spoke with me, and having turned, I saw seven golden lampstands. And in the midst of the seven lampstands, one like the Son of Man, clothed with a garment down to the feet, and girded about the chest with a golden band. His head and hair were white like wool, as white as snow, and his eyes like a flame of fire. His feet were like fine brass, as if refined in a furnace, and his voice as the sound of many waters. He had in his right hand seven stars, and out of his mouth went a sharp-two-edged sword, and his countenance was like the sun, shining in its strength. And when I saw him, I fell at his feet and said, but he laid his right hand upon me, saying, do not be afraid, I am the first and the last. I am he who lives and was dead, and behold, I am alive forevermore. Amen. I have the keys of Hades and of death. Write the things which you have seen, and the things which are, and the things which will take place after this. The mystery of the seven stars which you saw in my right hand, and the seven golden lampstands. The seven stars are the angels of the seven churches, and the seven lampstands which you saw are the seven churches. So what we see here is Jesus represented as being omnipresent in the midst of the seven churches of Asia. And as a result of being in their midst, spiritually speaking, he could conduct an examination, and did conduct an examination of those seven churches. And I believe that is simply a figure for the fact that he is even now with his churches, and he knows what is going on within his churches, and he is constantly conducting an examination of his churches. And so we're going to notice five things. I don't notice them all this morning. We're going to notice one this morning. And try to make this a series of short lessons instead of one long lesson. But over the course of the lessons, the series, we'll notice five things concerning this examination based on the results given in chapters 2 and 3. For all we know, and I firmly believe, Christ is examining us even now. And the same things that were true of his examination of those seven churches of Asia are true of his examination of his churches in the 21st century. First of all, we want to notice that the examination was personal. Jesus didn't send someone else to examine his churches. He examined them personally. He conducted this examination. He was well able to do so. He was omnipresent. He was in the midst of those seven golden lampstands in chapter 1 in the vision. And those seven golden lampstands represented the seven churches of Asia. And just as sure that he was in the midst of those seven congregations of Asia, he is in the midst of all the congregations in Georgia. He is in the midst of all the congregations in the southeastern United States. He is in the midst of all the congregations in the United States of America. He is in the midst of all the congregations of his in the continent of North America, in the northern hemisphere, in the southern hemisphere, in the eastern and western hemisphere. All the churches of his throughout the world, he is standing in the midst of them. Because he is omnipresent, he knows what's going on, and he is personally conducting an examination. He's not going to reveal to us, like he did to the seven churches of Asia, in specific terms, the results of that examination. Rather, he has revealed to the first century, those seven churches of Asia, and all the churches of the first century, and all the churches of every century between then and now, and even to us in the 21st century, the results of that examination. And we can take that and we can make an application for ourselves, and we can ask ourselves, well, are we like this church? Are the things that he told them that resulted from the results of his examination, are they true of us? And there again, seven different churches there, seven different states or conditions, and each of them was different. And so we need to ask ourselves, are we more like this church than that one? Are we what we ought to be as one of the Lord's churches? He is conducting a personal examination, and we need to ask ourselves, what is his examination revealing about us? In Revelation 2, verses 1 through 2, we have the first of several statements indicating the personal nature of this examination. He tells John, to the angel of the church in Ephesus, write, these things says he who holds the seven stars in his right hand, who walks in the midst of the seven golden lampstands. I know your work, your labor, your patience, and that you cannot bear those who are evil. And you have tested those who say they are apostles and are not, and have found them liars. Now again, the seven stars were the messengers of the seven churches. I believe that is a reference to the person in each church who was responsible for intercongregational correspondence. Those are the ones who wrote the letters to other churches, who read the letters from the other churches, who read the letters from John, the apostle, who read whatever letters they might have received from Paul, from Peter. Because, you know, there were probably, almost certainly, letters written that were not preserved. I believe we've got preserved for us God's entire will. But there are letters mentioned in the New Testament written by apostles that have not survived. But we've got God's promise that he will preserve his word in its entirety for us. We've got all his will. We can know how we ought to conduct ourselves as individual Christians. And we can know how we ought to conduct ourselves as a congregation of the Lord's people, just as surely as an alien sinner can know what he must do in order to become a Christian, a child of God, a saint under the new covenant. So to the church, to the angel or messenger of the church in Ephesus, he told John to write, these things said he who holds the seven stars in his right hand, identifying himself from that vision in chapter 1. Jesus is the one that says these things, although John is the one who is writing these things to the church at Ephesus and the other six churches of Asia. The examination was personal. Jesus says, I know your works. Jesus is not receiving any information secondhand. He doesn't say, well, I have been told, or I think, but I know what your situation is. In chapter 2, verses 9 and 13, I know your works, tribulation and poverty, but you are rich. And I know the blasphemy of those who say that they are Jews and are not, but are a synagogue of Satan. I know your works and where you dwell, where Satan's throne is. And you hold fast to my name and did not deny my faith, even in the days in which Antipas was my faithful martyr who was killed among you where Satan dwells. There were two different congregations addressed in the church of Asia, churches among the churches of Asia. The one says, well, you know you are in poverty, physically, materially speaking. I know that. I know your works. I know your tribulation. I know your poverty. But you're really rich. He knows their physical and material circumstances. He knows their spiritual condition. In spite of their work, their tribulation and their poverty, they were rich. And I know the blasphemy of those who say they are Jews and are not, but are the synagogue of Satan. These are people who claim to be Christians, but they were really nothing more than Judaizing teachers. These kinds of people were among the seven churches, among the churches of Galatia. I don't know how many there were. There were probably at least four, Antioch of Pisidia, I told him, listen, nothing dirty, because it's only four cities mentioned in that particular area. But then there are also the churches in Cilicia, Tarsus being the city from which Paul was from. Cilicia may also have been considered in that area of Galatia. But here were these Judaizing teachers, here were these Jews. Paul in Galatians chapter 2 refers to them as false brethren secretly brought in. These were men who were claiming to have received Christ. They may have even submitted to baptism, but without a true belief in Jesus Christ and without a repentance to sin. And if they confessed their faith, they were lying about it. And Paul in Galatians chapter 2 says, they're false brethren brought in secretly to spy out our liberty. And these were the men, by the way, who were responsible at Antioch of Syria for maintaining that, well, you know, the apostles back in Jerusalem were saying that Gentile converts should submit to physical circumcision and keep the law of Moses. Well, the problem was that the apostles and elders and other brethren in Jerusalem were not teaching that, not as a whole. So they sent Paul and Barnabas up there. We read about that in Acts chapter 16. And they settled that matter by showing from three different people, from Peter and Barnabas and Paul acting as a team, and then from James, joined by the necessary implication that God did not expect Gentiles to submit to physical circumcision and keep the law of Moses. But they were these teachers. They were among all the churches, Jewish so-called brethren, false brethren. I think the word pseudo, the prefix pseudo-delphia, I think is the word. False brethren. Who were teaching this. That's what he's talking about here when he refers to the synagogue of Satan. It's not like Satan has set up a physical synagogue somewhere. He's talking about people who are in league with Satan, pretending to be Christians, pretending to be spiritual Jews, but really they are Satan's ministers. So he knows about this. He says to another congregation, I know your works and where you dwell. This, I believe, is Pergamos, where Satan's throne is. Pergamos was such a wicked city, and like Satan had set up his kingdom there, had set up the headquarters for his kingdom there. That's where sin was apparently at its worst. Corinth was another city like that, but over in Achaia in Greece. One of the worst things you can say about a person is to call them a Corinthian in the first century, because they were so base. And we noticed in Bible class this morning that some of them were adulterers, some of them were sexual deviants, some of them were extortioners. And so there were all kinds of formerly immoral people who made up the congregation at Corinth. But they had been washed, they had been sanctified, they had been justified, they had been cleansed. They had been forgiven. And they were no longer walking in those things. Well, that's the kind of a place Pergamos was. I believe he's talking about Pergamos. Well, that's more particular than what it says about the various churches in another lesson. But he says, I know your work. I know where you dwell. You know what they were up against. But I say we cannot use circumstances, negative, adverse circumstances, to justify sin. I'm not saying they were doing that. But in fact, he says, and you hold fast to my name and did not deny my faith, even the days in which Antipas was my faithful martyr, who was killed among you where Satan dwelt. The word martyr is actually a transliteration from the Greek. That's the Greek word martyr. If it was translated, it would be translated witness. But almost always, when it's translated martyr, when the word martyr is used, an anglicized form of the Greek word, it refers to a witness who died for his testimony. And so that was Antipas. I don't know whether he was in any relation to Herod Antipas or not, but probably he was in that time, but he had become a Christian. He was a faithful witness, and he was killed among them. This may be Sardis. It's one of those churches in Asia. But that's not important at this particular point. The important point is Jesus had conducted this examination personally. He knew their works. He knew where they dwelt. And he knew their situation. In chapter 2 and verse 19, I know your works, love, service, faith, and your patience. And after your words, the last are more than the first. Here was a congregation that was more faithful now than it had been in the past. It had grown in a faithful collective service to God. And Jesus wanted them to know. He was aware of that personally. He knew about their words. And most of the time, there are a few times when the word is used negatively, but most of the time, in these seven churches, the word work is used in a positive sense. He's letting them know he knows about those things, but a couple of times. It seems in a negative sense, and he needs to let them know that he knows about those things too. But I know your works, love, because of the word works is connected with love, service, faith, and patience, I'm convinced that the word here is used in a positive sense. And after your works, those positive works, the last are more than the first. And then in chapter 3, verse 1, he says, and to the angel of the church in Sardis write, these things says he who has the seven spirits of God and the seven stars, I know your works, that you have a name, that you are alive, that you're dead. Jesus had been in the midst of that congregation in Sardis. He had been in other places throughout Sardis because he was omnipresent. He knew what was being said about the church at Sardis. He knew that they had a reputation that they were alive. He also knew that spiritually speaking, they were dead. There's an expression I like to use it from time to time. People come up and say, I've never heard that before. Some of our brethren refer to us as mossbacks. And that is from the old adage, that a rolling stone gathers no moss. And what these churches are saying when they refer to us, for example, as mossbacks, they're saying that they are really on the roll. They're not gathering mass, but we're so stagnant, we're standing still, we're not rolling, we're not moving, we're gathering moss on our backs. We're mossbacks. Well, the Sardis, it was the opposite. People were saying they were alive, they were rolling. Maybe they were doing good. But they were dead. They were truly gathering the moss. Because they were not active, unlike the church mentioned in verse 19. And Jesus said, I know about that. Because I have conducted this examination myself. I did not trust anyone else to do it for me. Yes, they had a name, they had a reputation that they were lying, but they were really dead. In chapter 3, verse 8, I know your works. See, I have set before you an open door, and no one can shut it. You have a little strength, have kept my word, and have not denied my name. That open door refers to an opportunity. There was something that they either had the opportunity to do now, or they would soon have the opportunity to do. I expect it had to do with some opportunity to expand their work, or to be more successful in the future in their efforts than they had been in the past. He knew their work. This open door seems to be a type of reward for their work. No one can shut this door. No one can stop you from having this opportunity. Of course, anytime a door is open, you can choose whether you're going to walk through it or not. And they might not walk through it. That was not a gift. That was up to them, to walk through this open door, to take advantage of this opportunity. So no one else could prevent them from taking advantage of it. That's what he means, but he says no one can shut it. Do you have a little strength? Here was a congregation. It was congregation as a whole.
We had a little strength.
He was holding on. He was holding his own, so to speak. It just needed to take advantage of the opportunity that Jesus was setting before him. You have a little strength. Have kept my word, have not denied my name as a whole. Now, some of them may have. Again, little strength indicates great weakness. But it wasn't a dead church. And then he says in verse 15, I know your works. And this is to the church at Laodicea. I know your works. Here it is in the negative sense. That you are neither cold nor hot. I could wish you were cold or hot. They were neither on fire for the Lord, nor were they cold as ice. They had not in some figure of speech, they had not a firm room temperature. They were not dead. But they were not on fire either. They were not extremely active, but nor were they completely inactive. They were kind of in limbo. Or as he says, you are lukewarm and neither cold nor hot. I could wish you were cold or hot. He knows the situation. He conducted the examination himself personally. He knows this is the thing. This is not what John told him. This is not what somebody else told him. You know, when Paul wrote the first of his two letters to Corinth, the first of the two that we have, he referred to a report from the household of Chloe in chapter 1. Paul got some of his information about the church at Corinth from the household of Chloe. He received other information from other sources, and some had been given to him in a letter from the church at Corinth. They had written him, and they had asked him some questions about marriage and divorce, which he deals with in 1 Corinthians chapter 7. So there were a lot of different sources of Paul's information, but it had been a while since he had been to Corinth. These things had risen, these problems that he deals with in 1 Corinthians, they had risen since he had left. He was not personally aware of those things. But he reveals how he came to be aware of those things, and he is writing by inspiration to deal with these things, and so there's no doubt in his mind that these problems that he addresses are real problems there. But Jesus is not dependent upon a letter from the household of Chloe or a letter from one of the churches of the seven churches of Asia to tell him about their situation. He knows their situation. Unlike Paul, Jesus is omnipresent. He was there in the midst of those seven churches. He was not just in the midst of the seven as a whole. He was in the midst of each of those seven. Not in a literal sense, but in the sense that he knew what was going on. When Solomon dedicated the temple that he oversaw the building of, he prayed to God. It says in effect, when you look down from heaven upon us and see what we are doing, and basically he made reference to the fact, when you see us faithful, reward us. When you see us unfaithful, give us a nudge. But that's the point. That God's omnipresence. It's not that he is literally everywhere, but he's in heaven and he sees and hears all. He's not limited by time or space in his being. And so at the same time that he was with the seven churches of Asia, he was with the churches of Georgia and Alabama and Mississippi. He is with all the churches in all places of all times. because of his omnipresence. He is personally conducting an examination of every one of these churches. He knows our situation. Hebrews chapter 4, verse 13. There is no creature hidden from his sight, but all things are naked and open to the eyes of him to whom we must give account. So the examination was personal. Criticism was personal. Revelation 2, verses 4 and 14, nevertheless I have this against you, this is the church of Ephesus, you have left your first love. But I have a few things against you, because you have there those who hold the doctrine of Balaam, who taught Balak to put a stumbling block before the children of Israel, to eat things sacrificed to idols, and to commit sexual immorality. So that's the way some of them were. They had held to that kind of a doctrine and were responsible for influencing people to commit, to eat things sacrificed to idols, and to commit sexual immorality. In chapter 2, verse 20, nevertheless, I have a few things against you, because you allow that woman Jezebel, who calls herself a prophetess, to teach and seduce my servants to commit sexual immorality and eat things sacrificed to idols. He's probably talking about idolatry, which involved both of those things.
Oftentimes, a temple priestess would also be a temple prostitute. They may very well be some of those. People, you know, we tend to think of the first century people, especially the Gentiles, as being irreligious. They were not irreligious. They were religious people. But their religion was some form of idolatry.
And that was problematic. And so this idolatry sometimes slipped into some of these churches. The criticism was personal. Also, the promise of reward was personal. He who has an ear to hear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches. To him who overcomes, I will give to eat from the tree of life, which is in the midst of the paradise of God. He who has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches. To him who overcomes, I will give some of his some of the hidden manna to eat. Also, I will give him a white stone, and on the stone a new name written, which no one knows except him who receives it. Of course, I can't tell you anything about that stone because of what he just said. Nobody knows except he who received it. Chapter 2, verse 26, he who overcomes and keeps my work until the end, to him I will give power over nations. Chapter 3, verse 5, he who overcomes. This is not talking about the end of the world. This is talking about the end of the adversity that they are about to face. He who overcomes shall be clothed in white garments, and I will not blot out his name from the book of life, but I will confess his name before my Father and before his angels.
Jesus said, pretty much the same thing while he was on earth. He who confesses me before men, him will I confess before my Father, which is in heaven. And he who denies me before men, him will I deny before my Father, who is in heaven.
And that thing still holds true. He overcomes, clothed in white garments. Will his name be blotted out of the book of life? No. Will Jesus confess his name before him? Yes. He will. Jesus will personally reward those who are faithful unto death. Those who overcome the adversities that they are about to suffer. In chapter 3, verse 12, he who overcomes, I will make him a pillar in the temple of my God, and he shall go out no more. And I will write on him the name of my God and the name of the city of my God, the New Jerusalem, which comes down out of heaven from my God, and I will write on him my new name. To him who overcomes, I will grant to sit with me on my throne, as I also overcame and sat down with my Father on his throne.
He's not talking necessarily here about heaven. He's talking about a temporal reward here on the earth, not a material reward, a spiritual reward. Remember, God's temple is his church. Paul in Galatians chapter 2 mentions those who were pillars, that he was talking about the apostles. Now, they were not literal pillars. They were figurative pillars, not pillows. Over in Alabama, you say pillar, and they think you're talking about something on your bed or on your couch. But upright columns, or as they say over and over in Alabama, columns.
Maybe that's northeast Mississippi, where the subcontinent. But what's he saying? He's saying, I will give you a position of responsibility and notoriety in my temple or in the Lord's church. You will be an example because you have been an example. We're not just talking necessarily about becoming an elder, but just saying that people are going to look up to you because you will be marked, as it were, by my word as being one of my faithful servants. So again, his examination of the seven churches of Asia was a personal examination. He was personally aware of those situations, and thus his criticism was personal, but also the rewards will be personal. He will personally reward those who overcome. I know you're facing adversity, some of you more than others. I face adversity from time